My ambition after that trip to the Highlands was simply to see if Tasmania could make a really good single malt whisky.
We don't expect everyone to like these wines, so yes, there's some risk.
Drink more sherry, because that's when you can really educate yourself on what happens in maturation.
The thing is with Australian natives, you put them in a gin, the aftertaste invariably is just bitter and unpalatable.
I think the Irish whisky landscape is going to be wildly different over the next 5 years.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits, and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. We're joined this episode by Chris Malcolm from recently launched Tasmanian whisky brand Hidden Lake. If Chris's name sounds familiar to you, that's because he's had a hand in several of the most significant Australian whisky ventures of the last decade. Chris was an early investor in Lark Distillery, going on to become its executive chairman and then CEO of the related entity, Australian Whisky Holdings. He was an early investor in and director of Top Shelf International, and he's currently a director of leading oak barrel supplier Master Cask, whose founder Darren Lange we met back in March 2020. Today, Chris is director of group whisky production for ASX-listed craft beverages accelerator Mighty Craft, a role that gives him oversight of distilleries including Kangaroo Island Spirits, 78 Degrees, formerly known as Adelaide Hills Distillery, and Seven Seasons. Joining that portfolio is Hidden Lake, Chris's personal project launched in partnership with Mighty Craft. And there's a rather colourful backstory here, as Hidden Lake's first whiskies were originally distilled at Tasmania's controversial Nant Distillery. To recap, Nant collapsed in 2017 in a cloud of fraudulent activity that cost small investors upwards of $20 million. We had Lark's former managing director, Jeff Bainbridge, on the podcast to talk about untangling the Lark brand from Nant in November 2020. Now it's time for Chris to tell his side of that story. He says it was Lark's lowball offer to investors, and those are definitely his words, not mine, that enabled him to get his hands on some of Nant's best barrels. Some of those are now hitting the market under the Hidden Lake name. And meanwhile, he's laying down more whiskey while looking to acquire a distillery that will be the production home of Hidden Lake. And that's just some of what's coming up in this wide-ranging interview with Chris. Well, Chris Malcolm, thanks so much for joining us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Pleasure, James. Good to see you.
Great to finally meet you. And, you know, your name will probably be pretty well familiar to anyone who's interested in Australian whisky. I'm kind of interested to go back to the beginning and just understand a little bit more about yourself and your career background and how you became interested in whisky.
Well, gee, that goes a long way back, James. When I arrived in Australia, I ate and drank to survive. And I was soon introduced to a young lady who I ended up marrying. She was French. Father ran a French restaurant. And I discovered food, and then I discovered wine. And that was the journey of my palate. And I've been on that journey ever since. So I've learned as much as I can about wine, and then I graduated to whiskey. And from there, once I found out how complex whiskey was as a drink, I've just pursued that all my life. So, you know, I've been drinking whiskey seriously for about 30 years or so and thoroughly enjoying the journey.
Were there any particular epiphany moments where whiskey's concerned?
I don't really think so. I think it's just been an awakening and a gradual learning process. There's no doubt that there were sort of pivotal moments when I got involved as a very early first investor with Lark Whiskey, and then later on with Overeem, and then later on I bought Nant for the public company, Australian Whisky Holdings, which I was CEO of, at the same time as being chairman of the private company, Lark Distilling. So those were pivotal moments when I saw the product from grain to bottle, and that was exciting. I think one of the most amazing trips I ever did was an invitation from Simon, the MD of Brookladdie, to an Isla festival and spent a week with him and his team, and that was just awesome.
And in terms of your background prior to entering the whisky industry, my fairly rudimentary research turned up that you were involved with Clark Rubber, the retail business. Is that right?
Yeah, so I was the founder of that franchise business as a retailer. I'd always been a retailer all my life, specialised in franchising, and the old Clark Rubber closed. It never went bankrupt or anything, just closed. And I came along a couple of years later, bought the brand name, and started the business from scratch using a franchise model. And so I've always been in retailing all my life.
There are three businesses listed on the ASX today that are involved with whiskey, and I think you've had interest in all of them. If I'm not mistaken, I believe that obviously you were formerly CEO of Australian Whiskey Holdings, and I think you were a co-founder of Top Shelf prior to it listing on the ASX, and then now obviously you're involved with Mighty Craft. Is that correct?
Lark was a private company where I was a major investor and his executive chairman. I then put my shares into a public company called Australian Whiskey Holdings, and we had 48.2% of Lark, the private company, but we spent 2 years struggling to get the other shareholders to list into the public company, but eventually it happened. From there, I got involved with Top Shelf or Ned's Whiskey, but I wouldn't be so bold as to call myself a co-founder. I was one of the early investors into Top Shelf and really believed the vision of the three founders, and then eventually joined the board and then chaired their sensory and quality control panel. And I'm still an investor with Top Shelf now that they've moved into agave and to tequila, or what will be called mezcal. So Mighty Craft is the latest one, public company, which runs both beer assets, venue assets, but also whiskey, gin and vodka. And I chair the advisory board for the spirits division for Mighty Craft.
And are you still a shareholder in the company now known as Lark Distilling, formerly Australian Whiskey Holdings?
Thankfully not. I caused a little bit of a ripple and a ruckus, and the then CEO used a colourful word to describe me because I sold out 100% of my shares through the broker Baron Joey the same day that Lark Distilling raised their 50-odd million through Baron Joey. So I was very happy to leave as the second largest shareholder at $5 a share compared to where it is now. No, I'm not an investor anymore with Lark Distilling.
Today we're here to talk more about Mighty Craft and Hidden Lake, although Hidden Lake obviously is linked to your time at Australian Whiskey Holdings, because that's kind of partly how you managed to get your hands on some of these casks. So maybe just sort of talk us through how that all unfolded.
So James, these are fairly colourful stories, and I think will become part of Australian folklore in the years ahead. But back in those days, we had Lark in the private company, and we had the public company Australian Whiskey Holdings, which owned, as I said, 48.2% of Lark. And in Lark, we also had Overeem. We had bought that business at that stage, and we were running that very successfully. Absolutely fantastic brand, and Casey Overeem just so focused on what he wanted his whiskey to be, and that was a fabulous learning experience for me. But Nant Whiskey came up as an opportunity at that time, and as CEO of Australian Whiskey Holdings, I was the lead on acquiring that business for the public company. So I was the first person in there to open it up and to audit the whiskey and to audit what had been going on. And of course, that showed that the former owner had not been able to fill the barrels that he'd sold to investors. So a lot of people lost their money with the previous owner. And so I spent 3 years of my life cleaning up that mess, 3 years of my life that I'll never get back again, but a fabulous learning experience, because the whiskey at Nant was fabulous. One of the things that the original founder had done is he'd brought in Jim Murray, Jim Murray's Whiskey Bible fame, in the early days of starting that distillery. And so the whiskey had headed in the right direction from day one. And I've not found too many bad barrels out of that 2,500 barrels that were made through that time. And of course, today, that's still owned by Lark Distilling, and they refer to it as one of their distilleries in the Lark brand.
How did the barrels that you managed to get your hands on, how did they come onto the market? How did that all transpire?
That's, again, these unusual things that take place because those barrels were owned by individual barrel investors. And so they had bought the barrel from the previous owner and they had a contract where the previous owner was to buy back those barrels on maturity. But those contracts moved into a company controlled by Australian Whiskey Holdings, which meant they had the right to buy back those barrels. So if you fast forward, Lark Whiskey went into the public company Australian Whiskey Holdings with Nant and with Overeem. And at one stage, the then CEO of Lark decided that he was not going to buy back the barrels of whiskey from these individual investors. They were written to and they were given a lowball offer for their whiskey. And if they didn't take that, they were given 3 months to relocate it to their own bond stores. Now, you can imagine as a small investor, you've invested in a $6,000 barrel and somebody says all of a sudden, look, I'll give you $2,000 for it. And by the way, move it in 3 months' time if you don't like the offer. Now, you may be based in Queensland, Perth. You think to yourself, well, how do I get one barrel out of the distillery in Bothwell, Tasmania? How do I get hazardous goods transport? How do I organise ATO transfer licences? Where do I find a bond store? And so they were really in a bit of a panic. And so a lot of these barrels came onto the market and I just was contacted by these investors because they already knew me from the takeover of Nant. And I just was able to select the really good barrels because I knew the history of them. Other people on the market bought them. Belgrove Distillery, Peter Bignell, bought up a huge number of barrels and launched a brand under those. It's gone very well from what I see and hear. And then other places like Trapper's Hut down in the island there, they've also bought up barrels. So a lot of people bought barrels and I was one amongst them. I wanted that, James, as the foundation for a Tasmanian whiskey. I think that Tasmania is just an amazing place, amazing talent, great beauty, and I think it's got everything that you need in the elements to make whiskey. So I wanted to develop my own whiskey brand. But of course, as you would know, you make the whiskey today, it's 3-4 years before you'll sell your first bottle. So what do you do in the meantime? And I felt that the quality that we had purchased or I had purchased of those barrels that had come onto the market would make a fabulous foundation to be released over 2 or 3 years while the whiskey that I was laying down would then eventually be mature to be part of the brand. In that journey, Mighty Craft and I had many discussions and I guess it's fair to say that the management there had a vision for a super premium Tasmanian whiskey. And so we got together and formed a joint venture. The first 120 barrels that we've laid down are 20-year-old Yulumba barrels. They've had port in them previously. And in the last few years, they've had a wine in them called Octavia. And Octavia is a wine that sells for $150 a bottle. So these barrels are just incredibly premium, hard to get hold of. I think there was only 150 barrels and we grabbed 120. And that was our foundation whiskey. So I was privileged last week to be chairing the sensory and quality control team for Mighty Craft. And we went through a tasting of these Yulumba Port Octavia barrels because they're now 12 months old and just beautiful whiskey. So that's the future of Hidden Lake.
So where is Hidden Lake distilled at then?
So we don't have our own distillery. We're looking for one. We're thinking about building one if we can't find one. So in that journey, we're using White Label Distillery down in Tasmania to contract distill to our recipe. And there we deal with Anthony White, who's their head distiller. And fortuitously, he was a head distiller at Nant as well. So he understands the product. He's got the history and knowledge from the past. And that's working really well for us. Jack Sellers, who is the last head distiller at Nant in Bothwell, he also consults to us as well on whiskey. So again, we've got that history and that knowledge so that we can marry all of that information to continue building our own luxury whiskey brand. And you know, we launched that, of course, this week in Adelaide and the week before in Melbourne.
Fantastic. And the barrels that you're talking about, I think Yulumba, the Octavius is a Shiraz, but then you mentioned some port barrels as well. They'd be different barrels, wouldn't they? Because I wouldn't have thought the Octavius would have been matured in export.
The same barrels, James. It's an interesting and you know, wood and how wood interacts with new make spirit fascinates me. And I just, you know, I love learning more and more about that. But these are very unusual barrels. They were coopered at 100 litres, which is unusual for a wine barrel. They were Sylvan French oak out of France, of course. And the first liquids that were put into them were Yulumba port. So they had port in them for many years, and then they were changed over to the Octavius.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, Starwood had recently released the Starwood Octave barrels, which was matured in those yeah. same barrels, I think.
Yeah. See, Yulumba's also a very interesting distillery because they have a little cooperage of their own. They don't really make barrels, but they repair and manage their own barrels. So they've got a unique understanding of their own product. And you see that coming through in the flavours and the profile.
Not to mention their own whiskies as well that we don't hear much about.
Absolutely. But I'm not going to plug their whiskey.
Fair enough.
They do well enough at that themselves.
With the spirit that you're putting down into those casks, was there an aim to sort of ensure continuity of style with the sort of spirit that was made at Nant and will be released initially under the name Hidden Lake?
No, we've departed from that slightly. I wouldn't say it's a huge departure because the Nant spirit is a lovely, light, beautiful spirit. So we wanted to continue that theme and quality, but we have gone a little bit heavier with the spirit. We've changed the gristing of the barley, so we've changed that profile slightly, and we're in the process of changing the yeast as well, playing with the yeast. One thing that's not done a lot in Australia, James, is playing with the yeast. And the changes you can get are just remarkable. So we're learning and changing the yeast as we go. The only other person I know of in Tassie that's playing with the yeast is Rob Palmier, who was the ex-head distiller of Overeem when I was running Overeem. I think he's an ex-marine biologist. So when you go up to his place at Warb Harbour, he's got a lovely little bar fridge there with a glass front door, and he's got all these Petri dishes in there, and he's experimenting with yeast as well, and I think doing a fabulous job.
And you mentioned that you're looking for a distillery of your own, so obviously this is a Tasmanian venture, and will this be a greenfields development?
Well, we've been looking for an existing distillery, and we're still in the market for an existing distillery, but nothing's quite worked the way we want it. We've not quite found the right match, so we're still working on that. If nothing comes of that, then yes, it'll be a greenfield.
And the advantages of buying a going concern would just be to hit the ground running, basically.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you know, going back to the stocks that you managed to get your hands on, you mentioned that it was a lowball offer that was put to these barrel owners. I'm assuming this was a much better outcome for them that they sold barrels to you?
Oh, certainly. Our offers were higher than at Lark Distilling, and that's why they sold to us. So they were looking for buyers because, as I said, they had 3 months to move their barrels, and lots of people didn't know how to do that, nor did they want to do it. And the cost of doing that for them was very high. So we simply negotiated with each individual until they were happy with the price and then bought the barrels. One investor I was talking to only a week or so ago, he wanted, when he sold his barrels to me, he was very specific in that he wanted a bottle from each barrel that he sold to me. So we bought a bunch of barrels from him, and I was just talking him through the fact that we're now doing 700ml bottles, not 500ml bottles. And he's got a bunch. He's got two barrels that have been decanted recently. So we're busy bottling and packaging his bottles and holding them until we've done six barrels, and then we'll send those off to him. So each individual wanted something different and had their own circumstances. You know, some people knew freight companies and could freight things. Other people wanted us to do the whole thing, buy it and freight it and do everything ourselves. So it was a one-on-one negotiation.
It seemed like a lot of the ill feeling from Nant investors that were burnt was levelled at you and the Australian Whisky Holdings management, even though they weren't the architects from the beginning.
Yes. Well, I think, James, it's an interesting part of Australian whisky history. All of the whisky brands that started up used the financial mechanism of selling barrels and buying them back to finance their whisky. So that's how Lark did things, and Lark was still doing that until recent times. Sullivan's Cove used the same financial mechanism to finance their whisky. The only problem with Nant was that the owner there took the money but didn't fill the barrels. So you can't stop people being crooks. And that's been investigated by the Tasmanian Police Force. We, in fact, Australian Whisky Holdings and the shareholders of Australian Whisky Holdings actually paid to have all the records, both hard copy and electronic, put onto one system and given to the police and given to the Australian Taxation Office. So, you know, to the credit, it is the shareholders of Australian Whisky Holdings, or what is now called Lark Distilling, that paid for the mess to be cleaned up. The problem was, though, the people that didn't have barrels, their issue was with the previous owner, because Australian Whisky Holdings didn't buy the companies, they bought the assets. So if the barrel wasn't there, we couldn't buy it. So the angst was directed at us because they had a target. They had somebody to actually talk to. I actually answered the telephone and talked to people, whereas the previous owners just did a runner back to Queensland and just wouldn't answer calls. So it was unfair. It was very, very tough, that whole process. And I guess we were simply there, so the anger was directed at us. During my time as CEO there, we honoured every contract that came up to be bought back. So all the investors that had whisky and they wanted to sell it back, we bought it back at that stage when I was CEO, and we paid the contract rate. We didn't pay less. That was a later decision by a new board and a new management team at Lark Distilling that made the decision not to buy them back and made lowball offers. I still to this day can't understand why, because it was great whisky and Lark Distilling needs large quantities of whisky. So to let that go and then also to leave that angst where people didn't get the full price, I don't understand that. But, you know, these things happen.
Moving on to the whiskies that you've released as part of this initial collection, and maybe you could just sort of run us through them.
Well, we've released six single barrels. We've tried to release only single barrels and cask strength if the whisky is that standard. And we've been very fortunate. The first six barrels that have reached maturity are certainly at cask strength. So we've had a bunch come through. We've had American oak with tawny in it. We've had French oak with tawny in it, so that you had a real interesting contrast between the French and the American oak and how it affects tawny, or what the old name used to be, port, before we were unable to use those names. We had American oak with sherry in it as well, which was an interesting contrast. And we had a couple of white oak or virgin oak barrels as well. So quite a spread of whiskey. There's six expressions in total.
Are they all still available? Because they're pretty finite amounts, aren't they, of these whiskies?
Yes, limited bottle numbers, very rare, very limited bottle numbers. I believe that there is certainly bottles of all of them, with possibly the exception of barrel 195, because one of the unusual things about Hidden Lake is that the whiskies we released were 6 years old, 8 years old, and barrel 195 was 10 years old. So for an Australian brand to be releasing aged whiskey at 6, 8 and 10 years old, I think that is an all-time first. Quite mature whiskies. Barrel 195, just a beautiful, beautiful whiskey, 67% ABV, just gorgeous. I think that's all sold out already. So when I was in Adelaide 2 days ago, I think we only had like 6 bottles left. So I think by today it'll be all gone.
What will the pipeline of future releases look like under the Hidden Lake name? Will it be, you know, just periodically another set of whiskies will come to market similarly to these?
Yes. So we've been through the tasting of all the barrels and we've got approximate maturity windows. So in tasting the whiskey, we've got a general idea. So we can say sort of, look, in 2023, the first 6 months, these 6 barrels will be ready. And in the last 6 months of 2023, these 10 barrels will be ready. So we've worked out windows of maturity. But of course, you can't hurry whiskey, and the whiskey tells you when it's ready. You don't just pick a date and say it'll be mature then. So these are approximate ideas. And so we'll be decanting these barrels over the next 3 years. For the latter half of this year, we have another 6 barrels that we're currently looking at and decanting and just looking for where the sweet spot is in those whiskies, whether it'll be cask strength or at a different strength. We're working through all that at the moment. But there will be another 6 barrels to be released between now and the end of this year, this calendar year.
It mentions in the press release, you say, when it comes to barrels, we have the first and oldest white oak program in Australia. There are very few distilleries in the country who are using white oak today. In fact, I only know of 2. Now, when I think of white oak, I think of American white oak ex-bourbon casks, which I didn't think were as rare as you're describing. Are you talking about something different?
You've just said something which shows the difference between the two. So generally, for whiskey, you want something to have been in the barrel beforehand. In the old language, port or sherry, or what we now call tawny or a pira, or you want it to have bourbon in the barrel, right? So first fill bourbon barrels out of the US are big around the world, Scotland and here, for maturing our whiskey in. But it has had bourbon in it. So when you talk about a virgin oak or a white oak program, you're talking about the American oak, but it's never had anything in it. It's never had bourbon in it. So it's just pure virgin oak. And I was part of supplying barrels to Nant before it was purchased by Australian Whiskey Holdings and when it was purchased by them. And the oak that they purchased was a Kelvin barrel out of Louisville, Kentucky. And they went for the top end of that oak, which is 36-month-old air-dried oak. So you have a different seasoning and you have natural yeasts in it. And then whiskey was put straight into that virgin oak. And that's the only program that I know of that's been running consecutively over the years. And we've continued that on at Hidden Lake because it's unique. And we've released 2 of those, James, in this round. One of them is at 46% ABV, and the other one is at 66% ABV. And I heard a phrase in the wine industry where there's a brand called nude wine. And I love that expression for this white oak program. It's like it's a nude whiskey. There's been nothing in the barrel beforehand. And we're so used to having port, sherry, Tokay, Muscat, all of those old names that that the Europeans use, or bourbon, and we're used to that. And through the tastings this week as well, we were tasting those products. But then you taste it against a virgin oak program, and it's a nude whiskey. There's been nothing in that barrel. I mean, it's the oak, and it's your new make spirit just reacting. So the contrast between other whiskies is amazing. Now, you either like it or you don't like it. It's like peated whiskey. You know, you're either a peated fan or you're not, or you think it tastes medicinal or something. When you taste those white oak whiskies, they are quite unusual. In Adelaide, we had Toby. He's an ex-New Yorker. been in the alcohol business. And when he tasted that, his comment was his palate is really dry at the end of a long finish, but it's Moorish. He's going, oh, I wouldn't mind another one of those. So, you know, he was quite taken by that. I find that just interesting. And it's unique and rare. You know, it's an experience you need to have if you're a whiskey fanatic.
And you think that that virgin American oak character is complementary to the new make spirit that you're making at Hidden Lake and that Nant made?
Yes, it was certainly complementary to Nant because Nant has a history of that now, and that's well accepted in the marketplace and being sold. And in fact, Lark Distilling are still selling some of those bottles to Dan Murphy's under the old Nant brand. And you can see them on the shelf. So that worked extremely well with the American oak. We're now running our new make into that. And of course, the oldest one is now only 12 months old. So, you know, my comment would be there in the tastings, so far so good. We have to see how that develops out.
How many barrels did you say you've filled at White Label Distillery under the Hidden Lake brand? Because you mentioned the Octavius, the Yalumba barrels. Now there's also the White Oak barrels. So are there any others?
When I talked about the Yalumba barrels, that was our first whiskey put down with White Label, and that was 120 barrels. I really can't remember how many barrels it is, but I can tell you there's probably $3 or $4 million invested in whiskey at this stage. I don't know how many barrels that equates to.
Sure. Okay. These are obviously, you know, very premium whiskies that you've launched. And as you've explained, you know, they're significantly aged for Australian whiskies. And I think the price point is understandable given the age of the whiskies. Is Hidden Lake going to be continuing to sort of operate at those levels of age statements and that premium pricing when your own whiskey comes online?
James, I would think so, because what we're finding is that you can release it after 2 or 3 years, and a lot of Australian whiskey is. But when it starts to get to that six-year mark in Australia and with Tasmanian conditions, it's kind of getting interesting. When you're hitting 8 to 10 years, it's really starting to get premium. And now these whiskies that we've released, we could have released them a couple of years ago when we started all of this, but we didn't. We hung on to get them to the 8-year mark and to get one of them to the 10-year mark. And the 10-year whiskey is just, I mean, it is just sensational. It's lovely. One of our entry point whiskies is 6 years old, and I jokingly refer to it as a breakfast whiskey because it's 46% and it's just so light and lovely. What we're seeing is that 8 to 10 year spot is a real sweet spot.
You think there's still very much a place in the market for that sort of premium offering, even considering, you know, the scale of production that's coming into Australian whiskey at the moment and more competitively priced whiskies as well?
Oh, yes. And there's two major distilleries on the go in Tasmania at the moment. One will be in the sort of the bourbon space. The other one will be in the real premium space, and really good people coming into the industry. So, yes, there will be much more volume on the market in the future with some really good players, quality players. But I think that the world is big enough to handle all the Aussie distilleries.
Now, you mentioned about your overarching role that you have at Mighty Craft with oversight for some of the other distilleries in the group and whiskey brands. What are some of the most interesting projects that you're working on there? You mentioned one of them before we started recording.
Yes, yes. I'll start with another one first and then come to that one. I mean, you'd be familiar with Kangaroo Island Spirit. Mighty Craft acquired that, and we were in negotiations with John Lark, Bill Lark's brother, and John Lark established that. I believe it's the oldest gin distillery in Australia, and Mighty Craft acquired that outright. So we then looked at the gin, and we really felt there was an opportunity for a whiskey offering. And John Lark had played around with a bit of whiskey, and there were a few 20-litre barrels that we inherited in that purchase. But if you fast forward, Mighty Craft has now established a new distillery on the same site that houses both a new gin still made by Stillsmiths out of Tasmania. We've just installed a 4,500-litre whisky still on Kangaroo Island. So we've just gone into production. Last week when I was in Adelaide, I tasted at the sensory panel our first bottle of new make that's produced. We designed the still ourselves and designed it to get a certain style of new make, and that's gone incredibly well. If you think about strategy, one of the things that I've seen through Australian whisky is that we're all self-taught. We only know what we know. We don't know what we don't know. And so I've been spending a lot of time trying to find a really experienced distiller to bring to Australia to bring that knowledge from Scotland. I was lucky enough to work with the head of the IBD, the International Brewing and Distilling, to find suitable people. And we found George Campbell. And George was working for Diageo. His last gig was head distiller for Glenfiddich. And before that, Balvenie and a number of others. George and his fiancée, Jo, came out to Australia about 9 months ago, based on Kangaroo Island, to get that all pulled together. And he has a fabulous pedigree, and he's also a wonderful young man, a lot of talent there. And so he's been working to get this up and running for Kangaroo Island. Charlie is going to take over from him as the head distiller on Kangaroo Island next month when George moves across to Adelaide. And George will then also be working on Seven Seasons that you and I were talking about. Seven Seasons makes a fabulous gin, really great vodka, but has never done whiskey. And so we've spent the last year or two working with Daniel Motlop and developing three expressions of whiskey well down the path. And that is now going into production. So very unique expressions, very unique Aboriginal history behind it. I was told by Mighty Craft team when I was in Adelaide that I couldn't tell anybody what the three expressions were, otherwise they'd have to shoot me. But three of those are coming through, very, very unique Aboriginal flavours, which comes from the Larrakia people, which is Daniel Motlop's people in the Northern Territory. So that's been just a really exciting project. And then, of course, there's 78 Degrees or Adelaide Hills Distillery, where we've ramped up production dramatically. And Tim has now taken over as head distiller, working under George Campbell, who heads up now all the distilling for Mighty Craft.
And Sasha's still involved, though, as well?
Yes, Sasha has moved now to become the ambassador for 78 Degrees, and so he's going to be more out and about promoting the brand that he founded. Sasha was with us last week on the Century panel, so yes, so that's a good journey.
For sure, and you know, how do you feel about the future of these whisky brands as part of a company that has its fingers in a lot of pies at Mighty Craft? It's not a simple business, is it? It's quite complicated.
Well, it's really complicated, James, because they've got all of these beer brands and then they've got venues as well. And brands such as Mismatch Brewery up in the Adelaide Hills is one of the beer brands of Mighty Craft, which is going very well. Then, of course, Jetty Road on the Mornington Peninsula in Melbourne. But the one that's absolutely flying is Better Beer. I believe it's the fastest growing craft brand in the last decade in Australia. So just flying. So managing all of that's quite challenging. And I guess that's why I focus on the spirits area to just help develop that as it comes through. So it's a complex offering to the market because it's got all of these different brands in different alcohol spaces. Then, of course, it does a bit of cider as well on top of all of that. So it's a complex animal, but certainly one that's growing. Sales have gone really well and the brands are really well accepted in Australia. And now we're doing a little bit of export as well.
Exciting times. Well, Chris, it's been fantastic to finally chat with you and put a name to a face, and look forward to seeing how things unfold with Hidden Lake and the other Mighty Craft brands?
James, it's a really exciting time to be involved in the whisky industry, specifically in Australia. And one of the things I said to the team in Adelaide when I was talking to our own team over there was that none of us should take for granted what's happening in the whisky industry or our role in it. It's a real privilege to be involved in Australian whisky at this time because the developments are just so exciting.
Fantastic, Chris. Well, thanks for your time.
Yeah, good to talk to you, James. Cheers.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at by James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.